Hi, I'm Christina.
And I'm Z.
We've worked in insights on both the supplier and brand sides.
And we've worked for software suppliers to the industry.
And we've been friends for a few years now and love geeking out over research topics.
Every couple of weeks, we chat about topics in market research and insights here on MR Explorer.
So Z, are you ready for today's episode?
Sure am. Let's do this.
Hi, Carrie. Thank you so much for joining us. We're so happy that you're here. We've talked about it before, but just to remind our listeners, you know, we're working on this series and introducing new methodologies or methodologies that maybe aren't as widely known to the wider market research audience through this new series that we're doing for the podcast. One of the methodologies that Z and I brainstormed that we maybe hear about a lot but haven't conducted ourselves is ethnographies. And so when I was thinking of somebody that could come and talk to me and our listeners about ethnographies, you came to mind. So I'm very happy that you agreed to come and chat with us. I'm really happy that you're here.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Let's start off with a bit of an introduction. Tell us who you are, what you do, your experience with ethnographies and market research. Love to hear more about you.
Yeah, I think that anyone in research, I've got to think, is naturally curious. Mm-hmm. And I definitely was. I am not a researcher by training. I did not study this. I was a journalism major, so I liked asking questions. I took, you know, photojournalism, I took fiction writing, I took classes in college, post-college, that were all narrative development type things, script writing, things like that. And so always wanting to understand the narrative arc, always wanting to understand the character, always wanting to understand what's going on in this moment. And so for me, when I started really working in this field, I think that it was just natural that that's where, you know, I gravitated to marketing. I started out in sales. I gravitated to the marketing side. I gravitated to the strategy side of being able to pull the story together. And I launched Brand Lab in 2001 after having worked in-house for companies. So I'd been with Ralph Lauren, I've been with Union Bay Sportswear, I've been with Nordstrom, and in always in some form of marketing role. I was not doing ethnographies for any of those companies, but we were obviously doing research, and it tended to be more focus group, you know, back then,
a lot of
focus group work. But it was all under that qualitative umbrella of trying to understand and being able to ask those more nuanced questions to probe. So that's where it really started. And then when I came out with my own business, you know, that there was opportunity through some of the projects to really do what is technically more what I think of as ethnography. But it's really important to clarify that I'm a brand strategist. I'm not a market researcher. You know, so my approach is really partnering. If there are times when I'm leading some research, even though I'm not technically trained in it, after this many years, I am able to do some. But the goal, you know, is obvious in anything is discovering those little golden nuggets of insight and probing for the nuances, really bringing the story to life.
I love that you mentioned that, you know, you don't think of yourself as a researcher. That's not where you have been trained. Make it very clear you are not a market researcher. But I think that highlights what the value is of knowing how to ask questions, how to get to that natural arc of who a brand is talking to and how important it is. How important it is to prioritize getting those, like you said, those little nuggets of information. That's what makes research so incredible and useful.
I think that the appeal of, you know, where ethnography fits into, obviously, I'm attracted to qualitative. I'm brand strategist, so I'm very attracted to qualitative. I promise I don't close my ears to quant, but I really want to get into that qualitative and dig in. Yeah. And what I love about ethnography is that that research is really from the perspective of the subject. So that is what, to me, distinguishes it, is that, you know, it's just that, can I get into the eyes? Can I get into the world? Can I get into the light? Can I see things and hear things through the subject's eyes or light? And so it's true behavioral research. And that, you know, obviously brings depth and richness of insight.
Absolutely. Carrie, as you're talking about ethnographies and what they are, sometimes they can get tossed around like a buzzword, right? It's just like, oh, we're going to run an ethnography, and no one really seems to be clear on what it is and what that means. Give us a little background just explaining, if someone hears the word ethnography, what should they be thinking? Like, describe what an ethnographic research actually is.
Yeah, it really is observational in its purest form. And so Jane Goodall going out and sitting in the jungle watching the apes, that's the, you know, the gorilla, that is true, pure ethnography. And there was a lot of question about whether it was pure enough within, you know, her field at the point that she was developing relationships with them. So there's pure ethnography where you truly are observational and seeing the subject in its natural environment without the influence of you being a part of it. Right. For me, and there've been anthropologists and ethnographers forever, but this Paco Underhill wrote the book Why We Buy, and I'm going to date myself. I think it was back in the 80s, possibly 90s. But that book for me was really eye opening. And he was, bringing an anthropological approach to research. He'd been asked by a friend, and I may be paraphrasing the story incorrectly, but he'd been asked by a friend if he could help him with his retail issues. But he was not from the market research or from the retail industry. And so he set up a study. He was observing what was going on as an anthropologist would. And there's this wonderful chapter that talks about the butt swipe. And it was this situation where neckwear was not selling. And they couldn't figure out, they'd given it that front and forward position. It was on a table. It was beautifully displayed. Why was the neckwear not selling? And so they observed, and they, you know, cataloged all this information of watching what was happening for people, and it was the position of the table, because it was too close to the door, and when things got busy, people were getting their butt swiped by passersby, and they were pulling up and then leaving.
Oh,
and
my
so
gosh.
They chronicle this story of what was going on, and this, you know, so it wasn't that the neckwear was wrong. It wasn't that the display was wrong. It was just a few feet of distance
right.
That was the issue. And so it's those kinds of, you know, it's the questions, you know, why is this happening? How is this happening? It's the how and why that you want out of ethnography that is, so that's true, what I think of as true observational. And his company, EnviroCell, will literally do studies where they're going in and can use digital now, but as well they were using human-powered, where they would, you know, true scientific reporting, how many seconds, clocking how many seconds somebody looked at this or did, you know, there's a level and a rigor to the protocol that is much more what I think of as scientific and truly more anthropomorphic. For me, the reality of what most of us are doing is not quite as disciplined as that, nor do we have the budget for that.
Yeah.
So then there's the morphing of what all sits under that umbrella of some form of ethnography. And so you've got shop-alongs, you know, the in-store shopping shop-along. But you are inserting yourself into that experience. You're part of going with them. They know you're there. You may have conversation as you're, as they're shopping. You may probe the experience. But it is a form of ethnography for sure.
Right. Right.
You know, and then it goes to much more, you know, limited and specific environments where, you know, you might be going into someone's home. There's UX. To me, UX is a form of ethnography where you're really watching how somebody interacts with the and surfs and engages. And so that's a form, in my mind, of ethnography. And in home, you can be as scientific, you can be digital, you know, you can be removed and set up cameras and truly observe. A lot of people do in-home interviews, and I've done a lot of that work. And that work even falls into different buckets. You know, some of it, it's truly just an interview that happens to be in someone's home. And in other cases, it's been set up in a way that you're really going to spend some quality time with that person in their home. You're going to go into other rooms beyond the living room. You're possibly going to dig through their drawers. You know, you're going to ask them to possibly do something that they would typically do, or you're going to watch them do something they would typically do, and really be in a more observational mode than just purely interviewing. But that's where that hybrid of an in-depth interview and ethnography are coming together. And I love, I use all of those.
Yeah.
That is so great. I just love that. And I love that it's so, you use the terms anthropology and observation, and I like to use the phrase a lot when I'm in a situation where someone's behavior, or we're in a new environment, and it's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that, you know, we're seeing something. And this is just, you know, maybe we go traveling and we're like, oh, we had no idea that this is what this was like, or how this is how people are acting in this certain environment. And I always use this phrase of like, it's like we're living an anthropological study, you know, and now I can say, no, I'm doing an informal ethnography, and that's fine.
I think of it as you cannot be in brand and not have an ethnographic mindset. You are wanting to understand culturally and lifestyle, behaviorally, what are people doing? What are they up to? How do they feel about that? You're discerning constantly. And so that idea of not being in that, in the rigor of always thinking that I need to know the facts, I need to know what's behind the facts. I need to know the context surrounding the facts. And so whether conducting research or not, what are we observing? What can we discern from that behavior? What does that imply? And so that's where the creative part of brand management and of strategy comes into play. It's not a direct linear output of data.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great.
You know, Carrie, when you were talking about the butt swipe issue, we're not selling ties because people, like, with the location of it just wasn't working.
Yeah.
It reminds me of a case study I remember hearing about where an airline was trying to understand why these early morning people who were traveling kept rating their experiences so low. And they were like, we don't know exactly what's driving that. So they're doing quant studies. What they found was they were hungry when they got to wherever they were landing. And so they found, right, this is not something that would have come from a traditional satisfaction survey or a deep dive of any sort. But what they found was they increased their satisfaction scores by providing orange juice, coffee, and donuts when people got off the plane. It was as simple as that. It turns out people are just tired and hungry. And if we can hungry. Yeah, they're hangry getting off that plane. And as soon as they did that, it was like such a small thing, small cost relative to other programs that they were thinking of, right? But I imagine that had to be a result of ethnography and, you know, talking to some of those people as they get off the flight, like what's going on to get to that nugget that really just would not have been achieved otherwise.
Right. And that's where that intersection of the experience. So, you know, flying on a flight and just being there to observe what's happening and watching people coming in and, you know, their facial expressions and whether they're the interruption of the announcement, the, you know, are they being awakened to be asked if they want a cup of coffee? You know, all these things that you're taking in and observing are happening, and then being able to match that up with interviews that are, you know, or trials. I mean, you can do ethnography that is also, you know, and it's not true, it's strict ethnography, but the idea of creating youth experiences and witnessing the difference of what's happening. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those in my mind, and again, I'm not a researcher who's happened to live by their code. In my mind, those are all forms of ethnography in that we are going to observe and learn, and that'll be from the consumer perspective. And that's what, you know, that's where that richness is for me. It's giving it the depth, it's giving it the emotional resonance to topics.
I love it. So I know you've brought up a couple of different use cases. You've brought up a couple of different examples. I specifically right now work in a B2B research setting. I've worked in B2C before. I've worked in, you know, consumer goods before. I've worked in tech before. So I would love to hear just as an intro to how we could potentially think of how to integrate ethnographies into our arsenal, I guess, of methodologies to be able to help stakeholders and clients, et cetera. What are some examples of some business questions, both on the B2C side as well as the B2B side, that ethnographies could help answer?
Well, I think that, you know, that for me, it's always going to give you the kind of the how and whys. And so from a brand strategy standpoint, understanding the role that you play in people's lives, ethnography really helps bring that to life. Mm-hmm. You really are able to see. So for me, that informs strategy. The role you're playing in people's life is critical to strategy and for recognizing what future to start to brainstorm future opportunities. You know, you've got to understand the role that you have, that you're already playing in someone's life and that you have permission to play in their life. So definitely ethnography helps with that. From a product standpoint, you know, it's really interesting to me that I don't know how you can innovate without being customer-centric in design. There are those front leaders that just are tech for tech's sake, or, you know, because we can, because the materials and the technology allow us to, but the reality of adoption and the reality of the expense of development, you know, to me, you've got to be solving, you know, for the nuanced reality of human engagement and desire versus category or materials capability, you know, category drivers and materials capabilities. And if you want to own brand space, you've got to be solving through that lens of your customer from a very nuanced perspective. So your product strategy as well as just your innovation map are very much fed through ethnography. Detailing out a customer experience journey. You know, we can capture that in interviews. We can capture it through data. But to really detail it and bring narrative to each moment of the along that and to the connective tissue between those moments, that really helps to understand, again, the why and the how of a moment. That on a service level, so for especially with B2B companies, you know, I think about it just from a sales call. I have a brother who's tall and was doing business at a time when it was three-piece suits. And he had somebody make a comment to him, observational, who had watched him in a sales call and said, "You walk into the room, you're a big man already, and now you're in a three-piece suit, and you are bringing a lot of energy into that room that, you know, because they're watching that dynamic of a woman responding. I did a project for a fitness company, and they have sales associates that typically they were set up very much like tire companies are, where the selling desk was at the very back of the store.
Yeah.
But they were employing very athletic people who would come charging towards the front of the store.
Yes.
Yeah. And you could watch the expressions on people's faces, like, oh my gosh, they're coming at me. You know, and so recognizing dynamic in service experiences, watching that play out, being able to comment on those subtle cues, what you were talking about, Z, with this, just this subtle difference. It's not a big change.
Mm-hmm.
Go to a two-piece suit, not a three-piece.
Right.
Desks up a little front and forward, and be able to greet somebody from behind the desk rather than having to charge at them. Little things make such a big difference, but you have to have observed that and really felt it to know that that's worth the investment or the simplicity of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's so important. And, I mean, you think about all of these innovations that companies and brands want to bring to their customers that are totally off base because somebody that has never left their building, their own building, has decided, like, this is the next step in this product, or this is what we need to do to offer them. When in reality, if you would just observe your own customers, maybe you find out that they are using two products to do one thing.
Absolutely.
And all you needed to do was, like, and your brand makes both of those products. Imagine you could just have them go together, or like you can be that problem solver and increase the sales of that one product or that one product line, and you know that is a game changer for your business. You end up saving money from not producing this other product and not putting money and effort and people behind that, and you can shift focus and serve your customers better. All of what you said was customer-centric observations need to be driving these new and innovative decisions.
Mm-hmm.
That would make it, like, even just the tiniest change could make the biggest difference in revenue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love
that. And it's really when you go into, you know, someone's natural environment, you're seeing things beyond just their actions.
Right.
You're actually able to take in, you know, and given this moment in time, we are all getting a chance to look into one another's homes.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing the art on the wall. You know, I did one project that was, we knew that, quote unquote, the customers like color. That was, you know, that was proven in sales results. Customers like color. But to go into someone's home and see what color actually means in their decor, in their closet, in the way they put an outfit together, in the, you know, it took on a whole new meaning when we could actually see that it wasn't just color, it was artfully expressive, and that it was referential to travel, and there was a juiciness, you know, it was like, okay, there is something going on with this color and the relationship of it that is creating an emotional feeling that we can capture and talk about, and that can work its way into a brief and into a color strategy for products that is more than just saying they like bright. It becomes much more directional, much more actionable.
Yeah.
I think when we think about a lot of research methodologies, a lot of stakeholders, clients, they have really specific KPIs that might be driven by very specific outcomes of quantitative data, like a PSAT score or an NPS score or your marketing funnel or what is your recommendation level, all of those things. So in those being a lot of the key outcomes to many methodologies, is there anything like that? I mean, it seems like ethnographies are very, like, we've talked about, very observational based or and whatnot. So what's the key outcome? What's the key measure? Of course, you're going to have recommendations and insights built off of this research, like hopefully all methodologies will have. Otherwise, why are you doing it? Is there anything that is key to ethnographies of why you would do this, or what really you're looking for?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think of it as a great in process tool in that you're now bringing things to life, and so for me that part of it is critical in that this is the how are we going to do that? So it really feeds into briefs. It really feeds into action plans. It really feeds into how we're doing something, not why, and how much we can expect out of it. So the metric side of it, it's giving flavor to how we will do this. And so for me, most of the work that I've done that I think of as ethnographic is definitely going into a narrative context, a brief. Whether it's a product brief, whether it's a creative brief, whether it's a strategic brief, it is something that is giving us the story that everything can hang around. So I don't think of it as metrics based. I think of it as insight based, and it's moving away from an understanding that we've been taking for granted. Mm-hmm. And we're giving it dimension that we can actually act on. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It definitely
makes sense. Yeah. It does. It does. I think we tend to think so much of so many different research methodologies as so quantitative in nature that it's like, give me my top score, give me my top thing, my number that I can hang my hat on at the end of the day and say, this is what I get from this.
Yeah. There's and little things that are really, understanding the full potential of the relationship you're in with a customer, you have to observe the relationship. You have to observe your product or your sales or whatever it is in the field. You have to see what that is. To say that we serve avid skiers, okay, great.
What does that
mean?
Right.
What is an avid skier? Like, who are they?
Right.
It's like when I just pictured, if you were observing a shop along, let's say, and you were like an intimate, you were making bras and regular casual bras. And you're shopping along with this consumer that maybe has a different skin tone, and they're on a different spectrum, and literally their only options are what we consider nude, and white or black. Well, if you have a certain skin color, any of those three bras are still going to show through a white shirt or a light colored shirt or any kind of shirt. But because those are the only options she has to purchase, or they have to purchase, I should say, you wouldn't know that. You would just say, oh, the nude bra sells best. We should just keep making them.
Right.
You wouldn't be able to pull out that insight of, but would we get more customers and would we be the favorite of a specific ethnic group or minority group if we could actually make a fourth color or a fifth color or be more on a color spectrum than just white, nude, and black. And you wouldn't know that unless you were observing and speaking to them and listening to their concerns and frustrations with the industry of only being given a limited number of choices, and you just have to make it work. You don't want to. It doesn't bring you joy to wear that garment. It doesn't make you look forward to waking up in the morning and have to put this on and always maybe have to wear a sweater or something like that. Like, is that really the kind of product and that you want to put out in the world? Is something that's good enough?
Right.
And you wouldn't even know that unless you did something like this,
And observing someone's frustration at that moment. They're trying things on. They're coming out looking in that mirror, and you see that. You watch them go through that, oh, shoot. pulling on their shirt or tugging, you know, whether it's fit issues or whether, you know, just seeing where people grab on their own bodies as they're trying on, where they, what that facial reaction the first time they see themselves in that mirror, all these things that you really are taking in through a compassionate lens, through a lens of empathy, trying to understand, and then ask, you know, that's where the intersection of the interview, being able to ask what's going on right now, and trying to understand what you're reading in their face, and just like, oh, I thought because it was nude, I'd be able to wear it under my white t-shirt. No, I can't, you know. Right. And so those kinds of epiphanies about, you know, with that, I've worked with a backpack company, recognizing you can functionally figure out, okay, how can we hold everything that needs to be carried? Mm-hmm. You can functionally design something to hold everything that needs to be carried. Doesn't mean you've designed it the way people pack. And so, mm-hmm. so the difference of understanding how I think about what I'm going
in
to
in what order,
what I'm in first, and why I do it that way is a very different thing than just functionally making sure that, you know, you can carry X pounds and these items.
Right. Right.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. In the spirit of the 101 and the intro into ethnographies, I am very curious, what would be the recommendation that you would give to someone who they want to do an ethnography, they see the value in it, but they don't know where to start. They don't know how to put it together. Like, is there kind of an outline of sorts, like a checklist, some kind of like, here are just the very basics of what an ethnography includes?
Well, I think that you, with any research, you've got to start with identifying your key stakeholders.
Yeah.
And find out if there's an appetite for this. I mean, because it is, this is not, I mean, we live in a very numbers and digital insight-based world right now. And so this idea of discernment and observation, you know, I'm sorry to see how much of it is not funded that was. I do feel like people are coming back to it, but and there's the COVID impact right now, so we can talk about that separately. But right now, the reality of you've got to start with your stakeholders. You've got to be really clear on what you're bringing, what their questions are, and what narrative they're operating under right now. And so for me, a good outcome requires really documenting the hypothesis, the understanding of the narrative we're operating against now. We believe the following to be true. What assumptions are we, you know? And so that we're really going out recognizing our truth may not be the truth, and we've got, and are we all open to hearing that? Mm-hmm. These are the assumptions we have, or the questions that we've got. And then who have we been listening? Are we very open and very clear on who we have been listening to and who we need to hear from? Do we collectively agree to who we need to hear from or observe to feel good about what's coming back? Because this is the challenge with all, for me, with all qualitative, is that it's not numbers. I'm not going to go out and, you know, it's rare that you're, you know, you might do 30 people. That's a big, big step.
I was like, can we?
I know, that's a huge number for qual.
And I see a lot of things where, you know, especially with smaller companies where, you know, we're just going to go out and talk to 10 to 12 people, or we're going to shop with 10 to 12 people. But what we're looking for are those threads. We're looking for the narrative part of this story. And is there one that we're hearing resounding, or are there a couple different directions here? And so you're observing and pulling together and you have to be ready then to craft the implications. This is where discernment and you know, this is not a cookie cutter, you know, from A to B to C. It's tight. There's discernment in this. It's subjective. So ultimately a successful outcome is there's narrative clarity. I've got I can picture that story, I can picture that scenario, and I can picture actions I would take to either support or to further or to in response to that narrative clarity.
Yeah.
And it may be that there's two narratives. There may be two narratives come out of a study, but it's important that So to me, a successful outcome is the clarity, but you've got to go into it, that foundation of making sure we're clear on what we thought we knew and what that source of information was and how we've either built on that or countered that in this effort so everybody's on board with it, because it's not going to be massive numbers. So you'll always get the naysayer based on that they want you. And you can go out and vet and validate later with, but for me, the richness is in the depth of the insight that you're able to bring to your briefs or to your product story.
What I find interesting is theoretically, in any kind of market research approach, you're going to be talking to your stakeholder and finding what they need to know. What is the actual business decision being made? What I find so different about the way ethnographies is approached and the way that you've described it is it's almost like you need to do an ethnography with your stakeholders to understand what they are, like you need to observe how they talk about the consumer, right? So it's like you're constantly observing, because you first need to observe your stakeholders, get their stories, and then go out to the consumers themselves to see what is, how far off is the story that these stakeholders are telling themselves is happening versus what is actually happening. And it's just like everything is so observational and so story-based. It's like first get the story from your stakeholders, then get the story from the consumers, then figure out what's not, what does that mean? Where does it not match?
That's like, I had the same thought. You had one line that you said and you brushed right over, and both V and I's faces were just like, because we've both been in this situation where it's, what is the truth that we've been operating under? What is the truth that's real? And are they open to hearing that they've been wrong? And I think that is, and that's not to say anything about
customers,
stakeholders or difficult clients or anything like that. But I think that is so important when you're designing something like this and a study like this that's like, okay, if you really want to do this, you have to know that things might need to change, and you have to be open. And when you hear the results, or even when you're doing this work, you can't start justifying any of the differences of your truth or reality because you see it happening differently. Right. And I think that that's just so important. Like, I've been in a couple of situations where, there might be this question and they want to test something, but you kind of have to sit there and be like, well, is it even, do we even have enough time to test this? Like, what are the opportunities of this actually changing? So, like, do you want to know?
Yes.
Do you want to know if it's right or wrong?
Are you actually going to act on this?
If it's too late, then let's do like these two.
Save you a little money, save you a little time.
The good news out of it is that people, for the most part, people want to help people.
Yeah.
And the beautiful thing about ethnography is you're bringing to life a human being. You're bringing to life their struggle and or opportunity or whatever it is, but you're bringing to life this moment, this journey that they're on with your product or with the category or whatever it is. And I do find that if you are reporting it out in a compelling way, people, now they get to be the heroes of solving for these people. And there can be momentum off of that. There's definitely resistance, to the people who are very comfortable with the way they've been working or with what they thought they knew. But if there is openness to changing how we do things or how we invest, your analogy via the airline, and okay, if that's an operational shift,
right,
we're going to get that to them, that's an operational shift. But it was, you know, I can't imagine that it really cost them a lot of money, but it was a process shift.
Right.
And so, you know, are they open to change? And because qualitative lets you see how you could change to be more relevant and more meaningful. And that's the beauty of it. And it's also the place where you occasionally get some resistance to it.
Yeah. Tell me how the pandemic has been impacting the way that you're able to do ethnographies. Because what you've talked about is very much not necessarily socially distant and being able to get the information out. So I'm curious, you know, separate from perhaps just a withdrawal of doing ethnographies as a whole, what is it that you've seen as changes to how ethnographies get conducted now?
Yeah, and this is where, and I am not by any means an expert or deeply versed in the toolkit, but the ability to use digital means of record. So whether, and I have done digital diaries, you know, there are ways of having people share their experience, and you're not literally physically watching it. But you may have moments of engagement and process where you are. You can set up cameras, those kinds of things. I have, in the last 6 months, done a lot more in-depth interviews, similar to how we're talking now. And definitely, I find those incredibly fruitful. A, because people are locked up in their homes and they want to talk. But even prior to this time, the fact that people are in their homes and you're not intruding in, so that's where, you know, it is not as visually illuminating as going into someone's home, but at the same time, they also aren't reacting to you
physically. To having someone in their home.
And so they're more relaxed, and I definitely have gotten into some very intimate conversations, very forthcoming conversations with people through in-depth interviews, you know, using Zoom or whatever platforms people are using. There is a way through it. That riches, and it is asking people to share. And I think part of that too is when you're designing a study, when you're thinking about the recruitment for a study, making sure that people know what all you're going to be asking of them. Because if you want them to share some things about themselves, I had a study where literally I wanted to go into their closets. I wanted to go through their drawers. Yeah. I wanted to see how they organized certain products and how they, you know, what made top of shelf, what went back of shelf. And when you think about your intimates and your, you know, and drawers, that can be dicey. And people were, you know, they needed to be prepared that what the definition of ethnography was before they were signing up for it.
Yep.
Yeah. We have just a couple of more questions for you, but there's something that I couldn't really fit in with the line of thinking that we were going down, but I do want to make sure I ask about it because I do think that it's something that needs to be acknowledged and I would love to hear your thoughts on it, is what do you think, or how do you account for observational bias, where if you think that they might be acting differently because you're there, or they know that you're going to go through their drawers, so maybe they tidy up a little bit, or do you think they're acting differently because someone is watching them? How do you really, how do you approach that? How do you think about that kind of thing?
It's a reality, and so documenting the reality of it, not being misleading about that, where were things, you know, where did things happen organically versus where did things happen as preset. And you're bringing up something that really leads into bigger issues right now, is that the capacity to listen, to observe, to truly hear people, you know, it's a central theme to our social unrest and our social issues now, as well as to good ethnography.
Mm-hmm.
And so that for me is, you know, I think that recognizing bias and recognizing cultural bias in research is really critical, obviously. But who is doing the research and then interpreting the research? Because through my white older woman eyes, what I see versus what someone who is younger and ethnically diverse, you know, and lives in a, didn't grow up on the West Coast, what they see in a given moment, it may be very different. And so really great ethnography has multiple analysts. Really great ethnography is going to, you know, where you're really giving yourself a chance to discuss with others, what did we see here, what does that mean, and that you've got perspective that is not a single focused, you know, it's, that requires obviously budget, it requires upfront design, but thinking through who is going to, how are we going to analyze this and make sure that we are not bringing cultural bias into our assessment of that, and or how are we going to address that upfront in our report? And so it, you know, these are very close to thesis. I mean, in the way that they're, you know, you're doing your field report, you're, here's what we saw. Here's what we think, you know, you're saying upfront, this was the methodology. These were the people that were involved. Here are the biases that are potentially in this analysis. You've got to own that up front. But it's definitely, you know, the more hybrid the work is, the less pure observational, the more skewed the outcomes can be when you've got the potential for people being performative or guarded. And so you really need to think that through. And you need to look at your recruitment from that. You know, what lists are, I did it, and it, with your audience, you said, you know, the number of people are early in their careers. I didn't realize how different agencies' lists were and how recruitment was done, and to recognize that, you know, there are unconscious and or systemic biases in recruitment practices. You know, you're creating your own communities. People who have these ready lists, they created a community incentivized in certain ways, built in certain ways. You really need to understand that before you sign up for the recruitment.
Interesting. I think, and this we've alluded to where we're going in our next question, in our next topic. You said now a few things. One, having researchers of different ethnic backgrounds, different ages, different genders, because we've all had many different life experiences that help us interpret our observations a very specific way. And you said my favorite buzzword of 2020, empathy. You said empathy a few times. So I think that it is just so important to, in all market research methodologies right now and forever and before, to have a mindset of diversity and inclusion, and making sure that we're hearing our customers' voices and potential customers' voices. Who are we missing? Who are we? Who is out there that we could be serving very well, but we have chosen consciously or unconsciously not to hear because maybe they're not our primary. I just feel like so many brands have this, who's driving our business? So that's who we're going to research so that we can be better for this one group that is driving our business. When in reality, it's
the difference between here is who we have identified as our big customer and what are you missing because you have narrowed your scope so
it's
much.
It's like that of being able to expand your customer base as opposed to just make your existing customer base buy more. Like, you know, so I would love to hear your thoughts, and you've already said several, so I will stop and let you continue on that train of thought. Of just how in the design phase can we make sure that our research and our observations and how we're designing this type of work is inclusive and ethical, really?
Yeah, one of the, I heard a really great interview with IDEO. Are you familiar with IDEO?
Yeah,
okay.
Yes.
So it was the chief of staff, whose name is going past me right this minute. But she was talking about really understanding and and seeing diversity and, more importantly, inclusion work, diversity and inclusion work, through the lens of being expansive, that you need to recognize it's an expansive mindset. And so that idea of, you know, and for me as a brand strategist, I'm thinking about, I've identified this relationship I'm going to be in with my audiences. And I'm gonna, and as a brand, we're gonna play this role in their lives. Who all can we play that role with? And so obviously we've got moments where from a marketing perspective we're gonna target them, but I wanna, who all has that mindset? Who all has that? Who all can share in this with us? And so I don't want to look only at the target market. I want to look at all who share in our or have the possibility of sharing within this mindset and understand what they're experiencing and what they're thinking about. We keep seeing studies that talk about even within every facet of our lives, whether it's personal relationships or whether it's professional, that the more diverse they are, the richer and the more productive and the better they are. And so the results, you're seeing it in corporate studies, you're seeing it everywhere. And so for me, I think that's the same way about the brand world.
Yeah.
The more expansive we can be and the more inclusive within that, the better.
Yeah.
I agree. Love that.
That is really cool. Kerry, it has been such a delight to have you on the podcast. This has been a super fun discussion. I have learned a ton. If people want to learn more about ethnographic research, what are some top-of-mind resources that you would recommend?
I think that, first, thank you for having me. This has been fun. It's always fun to wax on about all things qualitative. I do think that Paco Underhill's book is still valid, and it's a great read. I mean, that's where it's because there's some funny stories in it, why we buy. And his company, if somebody wanted to, it's called EnviroCell, and they do behavioral research, so I'm sure that, you follow their blog and so forth. I participate in trend watching, which is, it's actually an organization, trendwatching.com, and I'm a member of their community as quote-unquote a trend watcher. What I love about their approach on the topic of trend is that they are observing what's happening through products that are in the market and how that's influencing consumer expectations. Mm-hmm. They're setting, why that's important for people who are doing ethnography is to provide cultural context for what you're seeing. So I think that's a great piece for somebody who's new into this to be not just observing but putting it into a bigger and broader context and so having that balance. There's some great books. There's like brand. There's just a million books on the topic. there's definitely field guide books that talk about how to write an ethnography, how to actually, and then there's some that are just capturing, there's one called Tales of the Field by John Ben Mannon, and I love that there's he talks about the naivete of entering into this, thinking it was going to be lighter and fun, more fun and easier, and recognizing the reality of what it takes to do good ethnography work. He's a good storyteller, so the other is just to unleash your curiosity. I mean, really, if you've got a question, constantly be asking, how so, why? Like, get behind whatever it is you're seeing, and constantly be so use your iPhone, go to the store, follow somebody around, Take a look at what you just saw. Oh my gosh. Really see it. And then ask all the questions. I wonder why. How did that, it's critical.
Right.
I always heard the rule but when you're trying to dig in and be investigative, and this is when you're writing business reports and pulling insights and recommendations, a good rule of five whys. Ask whys five times and see if you can pull and pull and pull and pull and see if you can really get there, because there's always going to be one more layer that you can pull up.
Yeah. It's great.
We'll link as much as we can the couple of books that you've mentioned. And otherwise, thank you so much for being here. Is there anything coming up or anything that you'd like to plug or have us
know? No, I was happy to help out. I hope everyone remains healthy and able to connect in ways that are meaningful.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Carrie.
I appreciate that.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of MR Explorer with Christina Perkins and myself, Z Johnson. We look forward to sharing more with you in the future.